Good day. Today is Friday, 20th March 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, just a few quick announcements. Firstly, today, 20th March 2026, happens to be my birthday. I am treating it mostly as a working day, but by arrangement with my wife and children, we are actually going to the country. Tomorrow we'll be spending time in the country over the weekend. I will be back on Monday, but obviously we will be spending time relaxing with each other, and it is likely that my work rate, my production of programmes over the weekend will be somewhat reduced, whilst I fully intend to continue to produce videos. They will probably be rather shorter than the normal ones I make. So that's something to say. I will be back in London on Monday, and it should be work as usual from that day. Now, the second thing is just to remind you once again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this programme, or whichever part of the programme you want to watch, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Well, let's, with those two announcements, let me now move on to the substance, the material that I intend to discuss in this programme today. And my starting point is some comments made yesterday by Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel. First of all, he gave backing to the President of the United States, to Donald Trump, by saying that it was indeed Israel's decision and Israel's alone to attack the giant South Pars gas field in Iran. The implications and consequences of which, the awesome implications and consequences of which, I discussed in my programme yesterday at some length. And Netanyahu went on to say that Iran's nuclear enrichment capability had been totally destroyed, as had Iran's ability to produce ballistic missiles. And, well, on that basis, he again gave the impression that victory is near, and he said that he expected that the current military operation, which is now well into its third week, in fact, there was an article in the media here in London today that pointed out that we're actually approaching 1 month since the start of the military operation by the United States and Israel against Iran. Anyway, Prime Minister Netanyahu again gave the strong impression that this operation would soon be coming to an end with all of its objectives achieved. Now, this apparently happened after a conversation, a telephone conversation between himself and President Trump. And President Trump himself is clearly coming under a significant amount of pressure, as are members of his administration. Clearly, I have no doubt about this, and it is being reported now all over the media. The operation against Iran is proving much more complicated than Donald Trump anticipated, that other members of his administration anticipated, and the economic consequences of this operation are growing and are continuing to get worse and worse and worse, in ways that ultimately look like they will undermine his popularity and his political position in the United States. And in fact, I saw a few hours before I started making this program the results of an opinion poll in the United States, which showed that a large majority of Donald Trump's own voters in the United States want the operation to end soon, want him to declare victory quickly, and basically to walk away. And there are accumulating reports of higher prices at the gas stations. This is a always very politically sensitive issue in the United States. It's been pointed out that so far those prices are still well short of the peaks that they achieved during Biden's presidency. Those peaks having, of course, been triggered to a very great extent by the economic war that Joe Biden and the United States and the collective West decided to launch against Russia. So we are still not at those levels yet, but energy prices are rising. They will continue to rise. It looks increasingly as if, in case this conflict goes on, that at some point they might approach and perhaps surpass the levels that we saw during Biden's presidency. Now, Donald Trump is very sensitive to this issue, and he probably knows that it was these very, very high prices at the gas stations that ultimately undermined support for Joe Biden, and which led to the Democrats losing the presidential and congressional elections in November 2024, making Trump himself president. As has been pointed out by a number of commentators recently, just a few weeks ago, in his State of the Union address, President Trump himself pointed out how much lower prices at the gas stations were since he was elected as compared to the levels that they had reached under Joe Biden. Anyway, there we go. So Trump had this conversation with Netanyahu. He almost certainly told Netanyahu, under no circumstances conduct more strikes like the one that took place against South Pars again. And he undoubtedly put pressure, I suspect quite a lot of pressure, on Netanyahu to get Netanyahu also to reinforce this impression that the administration is anxious to give that the situation in the war is improving, that things are going well, that victory is nigh, and all of that. Now, here I'm going to make a few comments of my own. Firstly, I don't believe that the attack on the gas field, the South Pars gas field, was entirely the action of Israel. I've discussed this at length. I discussed my reasons for this skepticism at length in my program yesterday. And I was interested and a little amused to then read a very long article in the Financial Times, which basically said all the same things that I had said in my program of yesterday, that the Israeli and American command systems that are conducting this operation against Iran are deeply intertwined with each other, that it is all but impossible for the Israelis to conduct an operation of this kind without the Americans finding out about it, that in reality it is all but inconceivable that the Israelis would conduct such an operation without first discussing and consulting the United States, that the operation against South Pars, exactly as I said in my program yesterday, that that operation was a product of frustration, of growing exasperation, of bewilderment that Iran is still resisting and is fighting on, and is fighting on effectively, that the United States and Israel were looking for ways to increase the pressure on the government in Tehran in order to get that government to agree to a ceasefire. And that, I suspect now, is what President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu are seeking. I get the increasing sense that the high hopes that were there at the start of this operation, the stated objective that was set out at the start of the operation, regime change in Tehran, both Trump and Netanyahu, both the Americans and the Israelis, now understand that that is extremely unlikely to happen, perhaps impossible to happen, that they are now looking to end the war as quickly as they can, far short of that objective being achieved, that they want, in other words, a ceasefire as quickly as possible, so that the Strait of Hormuz can be reopened, and so that the situation in the financial markets can and the energy markets can be brought back to normal before the political and economic costs in the United States become so high as to put President Trump's position in political jeopardy. And that this is the purpose of the attack on South Pars, the idea being that this was such an important, such a huge facility, so central to the Iranian economy, that attacking it, doing destruction to it, that this would scare the authorities in Tehran into agreeing to that ceasefire. And again, exactly as I discussed in my program yesterday, the article in the Financial Times said that the Americans and the Israelis again misjudged the Iranian reaction. They did not anticipate that Iran, instead of being panicked into a ceasefire, would, on the contrary, itself escalate by attacking the gas facilities in Qatar and launching further attacks on energy facilities across the Middle East, and that as a result, a recrimination game has come into play, with the Americans trying to distance themselves from the Israelis and trying to put the entire blame for the attack on South Pars on the Israelis. Well, we see that Netanyahu, who understands that political calculus, those political imperatives in the United States, yesterday was prepared to play along. And you could see also that by talking about the destruction of Iran's ability to enrich uranium and the destruction of Iran's ability to produce ballistic missiles, he is also laying the foundations for a ceasefire, trying to get the Iranians to agree to a ceasefire before further damage is done. It is impossible to read what Netanyahu is saying in any other way. Larry Johnson, again, in his indispensable blog, Sonar 21, makes all these points. But the problem that Netanyahu and Trump both face is that, as a number of people are now saying, it takes two to tango. It's all very well for Trump and Netanyahu to want to stop this thing, but what if the Iranians don't agree? What if they say, as they have repeatedly said, that a temporary ceasefire will not do? What if they continue to keep the Strait of Hormuz closed? What if they continue to launch drone and missile strikes across attacking American bases and installations in the Middle East? What if they continue to launch missile strikes on Israel? We're getting very little information about the missile strikes on Israel that the Iranians have been conducting. It is undoubtedly the case that civilian casualties appear to be very few, perhaps significantly below the levels of the 12-day June 2025 war. But there are now reports, touched on again by Larry Johnson in that same article in Sonar 21, that exactly as happened over the course of the June 2025 war, the damage that the Iranian missile strikes on Israel are doing, that damage is compounding, that we are now approaching that point when the damage is going to start to have significant effects on Israel's ability to sustain the war and on its economy altogether. Of course, this is very difficult to track. The Israeli authorities keep very tight control over information about damage which is done on their own country. But I understand that there is some footage of Iranian ballistic missiles hitting the giant Nevatim air base, for example, in the Negev desert, a target that the Iranians absolutely did attack during the June 2025 war, that the Iranians have inflicted damage on other critical facilities within Israel. I don't want to say more than I know, but there are reasons to think, let's put it no higher than that, that the Iranians are doing significant damage in that sort of way. And despite the confident claims that the Iranians have been massively damaged as a result of the missiles and the airstrikes that have been taking place against Iran, everything points to Iran still being fully in the battle and still rejecting the temporary ceasefire. In fact, there was a very facetious comment made in The Economist that, yes, Iran's military capabilities have indeed been 100% degraded, but it is the 0% of those military capabilities which have not been degraded that is causing all the trouble, that is causing all of this massive disruption right across the global economy. In fact, you can see in comments like this in The Economist, a magazine which, to say it straightforwardly, is about as neocon as it gets. you can start to see the credibility gap that I spoke about, the situation in which the US government and the Israeli government talk about progress in the war, whereas more and more people can see that no progress or no real progress is being made, and they start to question and doubt everything that the US government and the US authorities are saying, until the point is finally reached when whatever the US authorities say is no longer believed or taken seriously anymore. The expression credibility gap appeared towards the end of the Vietnam War in the United States, and it seems to me that events are tracking that, only they're doing so this time at something approaching to warp speed. And about a week ago, I remember the US Defense Secretary, or is it War Secretary, Pete Hegseth, saying that the United States has achieved total aerial dominance over Iran, to the point where US heavy bombers dropping gravity bombs can operate across Iran at will. Brian Beletic, in a program that he did on his channel, The New Atlas, and I have expressed deep skepticism about this, as incidentally have many others. Well, yesterday the Iranians released footage showing a US F-35 stealth fighter jet apparently being engaged by the Iranian air defences. Interestingly, there's been no denials that I'm aware of from the United States that this footage is false and that an F-35 was not engaged by the Iranians. So it seems as if this footage is true, that an F-35 was indeed tracked by Iranian air defences over Iran, that it received damage. The word from the Americans is that it received damage and was able to return to its base in Saudi Arabia. There are some rumours circulating whose accuracy I cannot in any way corroborate or confirm, but there are some rumours that in fact the F-35 crashed in Saudi Arabia before it landed, and that the pilot had to parachute to safety, and that there's footage apparently of helicopters, American helicopters, flying around the Saudi Arabian desert, seeking to track him down and to rescue him. Well, I don't know whether any of that is true. But the key thing is that the Iranians do seem to have had success in engaging an F-35 stealth fighter jet over Iran. Now, putting aside that this does rather dent the story of the F-35 as being a aircraft that is mostly invisible to Iranian air defences, I've been hearing this story circulated from many places altogether. But putting all that aside, it does confirm that at least in some parts of Iran, the Iranians still do maintain functioning air defences, and that the claims by Pete Hegseth of total American dominance of the skies over Iran are simply untrue. Incidentally, before I move on, just to say, just to add, that the Russians have apparently for some time now, perhaps a year and a half, deployed their stealth fighter jet, the Sukhoi 57, over the skies of Ukraine. There's been much criticism of the Sukhoi 57, many claims that it's not really a stealth fighter jet at all, that its stealth capabilities are overhyped by the Russians. Many comparisons have been made between the stealth capabilities of the Sukhoi 57 and the F-35. Well, I'm not going to say whether those criticisms, if they are criticisms, are right or not. All I would say is that so far I know of no case of the Ukrainians successfully shooting down a Sukhoi 57, even though, as I said, it has been present in the skies of Ukraine. I know not in what number or what it has been doing there for some time. Anyway, returning to this situation, it's not just that the Iranians do have a functioning air defense system. The Iranians continue to be able to launch ballistic missiles. We've heard nothing further about the supposed success in destroying Iranian launchers. This is a big narrative earlier in the war. We hear less about it now. And missile launches continue. Drone launches continue. And, well, we are getting further information about assistance to Iran from Russia. And firstly, there's been a number of American-Israeli missile strikes on Iran's Caspian Sea ports. Now, the Caspian is an inland sea. It doesn't connect directly to any other sea. In fact, the Russians have created, or rather the Soviets created, a system of rivers and canals which do connect the Caspian Sea to the Russian river system and ultimately to the Black Sea as well. But we can discount that. The only value, military value, that I can think of for Iran of its Caspian Sea ports is that presumably supplies to Iran arrive at these ports from Russia. And the fact that the Americans, I presume it is the Americans, are now conducting long-range missile strikes against these ports suggests that the Americans are now aware that Russian ships have been coming to the Caspian ports, unloading goods of various kinds, military goods probably, which are being sent to Iran. And there is further footage that points to something very similar to that also happening. And this comes from the Central Asian state of Tajikistan. Now, Tajikistan is a very, very close ally of Russia. The Russians have a military base in Tajikistan, and they also have a military base in neighboring Kyrgyzstan. And I've seen footage, I believe it originates from Iran, of what looks like an almost endless, unending convoy of trucks with the truckers flying Iranian flags, driving through Tajikistan, ultimately towards the Iranian border. And as I understand it, some parts of this convoy have reached Iran by crossing through Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan as well. Both countries also being heavily aligned with Russia as well. And, well, it is said that the goods in these convoys are humanitarian supplies. And I discussed again in my program yesterday that the Russians have been indeed talking about providing Iran with foodstuffs, basically so that the Iranian authorities can maintain supplies in the cities, food supplies and that sort of thing to the cities. But there is also, and this has been actually a long-standing thing, I've heard about this for some time, there are also reports that the Russians have established manufacturing sites, factories, in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan to mass produce drones, FPV drones, and who knows, maybe even heavier drones as well. And it could be that there are some of those also in those trucks. The United States and Israel would probably be very, very wary of conducting strikes against those factories in Tajikistan and perhaps in neighbouring Kyrgyzstan, because the Russians have military bases in both of these places, so that the Russian military is directly involved there. It is able to provide protection, and of course it is in a position to intervene. And the Russians almost certainly, because we're talking about the presence of air bases, they almost certainly operate air defense systems also, S-300, S-400, I don't know, anti-aircraft missile defenses, Pantsir, point defense systems, all of the various systems that the Russians have. So Iran continues to receive these supplies. And I actually heard claims, I don't know whether these claims are true, that F-35 that the Iranians successfully engaged over central Iran was flying over territory through which weapons convoys entering Iran from Central Asia, but ultimately providing Russian-supplied goods, that it was this area where that F-35 was operating. And I wonder whether perhaps its purpose was to try to interfere with this flow of supplies into Iran from Central Asia and ultimately from Russia, which might explain why the air defences in this area are still functioning. Probably they're operated by the Iranians themselves, but if they are involved sending supplies from Russia, quite plausibly there are Russian technicians involved there as well. It would be logical for a strong air defence system to be concentrated precisely in this area to protect the supplies that are coming through. And that might explain why the F-35 was successfully engaged in the way that it was. Now, if any of this is true, and again, there's a fair amount of speculation, but not excessive amount of speculation. We have seen the attacks on the Caspian Sea ports there's been the footage of this huge convoy trundling through Tajikistan. It is an enormous convoy. We have seen the Iranian drone, the Iranian film footage of the engagement of the F-35. If you like, it's a case of putting the pieces together. And if the picture that I have created through my exercise of putting the various pieces of this jigsaw together are in any way true, then it seems to me that the problems for the United States, for Israel in this conflict, are compounding. Because if the Russians, and maybe not just the Russians, because Tajikistan, I would add, has very close relations, very friendly relations with China as well. And there's every reason to think that the Chinese and the Russians are working closely together and coordinating closely together with each other in any matter relating to this conflict in Iran. If this is happening, if Iran is able to receive a constant flow of supplies and intelligence and perhaps some types of weaponry, drones, for example, missile parts, fuel for the rockets, that kind of thing, then, despite what Prime Minister Netanyahu is saying, it is all but impossible for the United States and for Israel to suffocate Iran, to close up its supply routes to the point where Iran is forced to agree to a ceasefire on their terms. The Russians, by the way, would of course be doing to Iran, with Iran, precisely what the West has done to them in Ukraine. It makes complete logical sense, except that for the Russians, the nature of the supplies they are probably providing to the Iranians are of a sort that are not going to deplete their arsenals dramatically or affect the Russians' ability to prosecute their own war in Ukraine. We're not talking perhaps about Iskander M ballistic missiles. We're not talking about that kind of thing. We're talking about a certain number of surface-to-air missiles and systems, of which Russia has an enormous abundance. But primarily we're talking about drones, drone technology and intelligence, which of course the Russians can produce in factories in huge numbers, and which the Chinese, if they put their mind to do it, could produce in quantities that would submerge those of everyone else. So if this is true, if this is the way things are actually going, then we can start to see that the United States and Israel not only have bitten off more than they can chew, as many people have been saying, but they face an insurmountable logistic challenge. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that the United States and Israel are close to giving up. They still continue to hunt Iranian leaders, even though the Iranians themselves have pointed out. They did so again yesterday, that killing Iranian leaders really has no effect in the war, because the Iranians can always replace one leader with another. The policy, the strategy doesn't change. Again, the Financial Times spoke about Israel's decapitation addiction. And I think that is a good way of describing this. An addiction ultimately, of course, undermines the person addicted. And we could see how that might be happening. Decapitation in Iran so far has been a strategy which has failed. And perhaps it's time for the Israelis and their American allies to start to recognize that fact. But anyway, the Israelis and the Americans, obviously, for the moment at least, do not want to acknowledge that things are not going well, that the Iranians are not prepared to cease fire in the way that they would like, that Iran continues to fight, and if it is getting the kind of support that I discussed, might actually be becoming stronger. So, of course, they're looking for solutions. This morning, I read in the Daily Telegraph, a media outlet which fervently campaigned for years for an attack on Iran. Just saying. Anyway, I read this morning that an American military operation to open the Strait of Hormuz had already begun, that low-flying fighter jets were already being deployed, that Apache helicopter gunships were being positioned and were about to join the operation. Well, I checked to see whether any other media outlet was reporting that. I checked Reuters. I checked all the big news agencies. I found nowhere anything of that kind. However, it is true that the United States continues to deploy US Navy Marines to the area. The USS Tripoli is now being joined, apparently, by two other similar helicopter carriers. That would increase, by my calculation, the total force to about 15,000 men. But Brian Beletic, in a program that he did for the new Atlas, and remember, Brian Beletic is a former US Navy Marine, he pointed out that of the 2,500 Marines who there are in any one of these helicopter carriers, only around 1,000 are in fact infantry. So all of these deployments of helicopter carriers, the actual assault force, the actual infantry assault force that would be deployed would number about 3,000 men, which, despite the presence of the low-flying aircraft, the A-10s, I presume A-10s or something like that, the helicopter gunships, still seems to me far too small to force open the Strait of Hormuz, let alone capture Harg Island, which we'll come to in a moment. But anyway, it still seems to me far too small. We're hearing less now about the 82nd Airborne Division, but presumably they will come into play before long as well. But remember, they also number in total just 7,500 men, and far from all of them are deployable infantry, probably only a quarter of that division are actually assault troops. So the numbers for the moment are still not adding up. They don't come anywhere close to the numbers that would be needed to either force open the Strait of Hormuz or to capture Harg Island or to do anything much against an Iranian military which is said to number around 1 million men, and of which, judging from its performance in the war so far, some parts, at least of it, are extremely effective. Now, it gets worse because a Royal Navy captain, retired Royal Navy captain, Tom Sharp, who writes mostly for the Daily Telegraph, has also made a further point, which is related to the Strait of Hormuz specifically. In a programme I did about a week ago, I said that the Iranians had begun mining the Strait of Hormuz. The Iranians themselves denied that claim. They said that they've not actually started to mine the Strait of Hormuz. For the moment, they're still sending ships carrying Iranian oil, mostly to China, through the Strait of Hormuz. So it's not in their interest to mine the Strait of Hormuz. But they do undoubtedly have the capability to do this. And this is a capability they are holding back and keeping in reserve. Now, what Tom Sharp said, and he is a formerly experienced naval officer, is that neither the Royal Navy, the British Royal Navy, which is hardly a factor in this conflict at the moment, but also the United States Navy too, neither of these navies is any longer configured for dealing with mines. The mine sweeping fleets, which used to be such an important part of navies in the past, have been massively run down on the part of both navies. In the United States, the focus was on the so-called littoral combat ships. They were supposed to fulfill the minesweeping, mine hunting role. The old minesweepers basically no longer exist in quantity anymore, except that by universal consensus, the littoral combat ships have proved a failure, and they are not well configured to operate in the restricted conditions of the Strait of Hormuz anyway. And yes, there are various technologies that the Americans and the British have to track mines, but these are expensive, they have their own complexities, they are not perhaps the best for this kind of challenge if the Iranians did choose to mine the Strait of Hormuz in a big way. Now, I have to say, that comes from a British naval captain who's had a lot of experience working closely with the US Navy. I assume that this is true, which I have to say I find absolutely remarkable. And one of the reasons I find it really remarkable, indeed even astonishing, is that the US Navy ran into problems with mines in precisely these waters. I remember how back during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, both Iran and Iraq tried to interfere with shipping in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, and the US Navy, with the backing of Iraq, but with some skepticism from Iran, then started to undertake escort duties to protect shipping navigating through the Strait of Hormuz. It's important to stress again that at that time, neither Iran nor Iraq were in direct conflict with the United States. So neither of these countries was looking seriously to interfere with this escort mission. But the Iranians had indeed sown the seeds in the Persian Gulf with a certain number of mines. And the American Navy, as it turned out, had serious problems dealing with them. And this is particularly remarkable to me at the time, since some of these mines, sea mines, that the Iranians had planted were former Tsarist Russian mines produced in, manufactured in Russia as far back as 1908, and somehow they'd find their way to Iran. I'm not going to try and speculate or guess how, but anyway, the Iranians managed to place them in the sea in the Persian Gulf, where, as I very well remember, they caused the Americans a great deal of trouble, and there were comments from American naval officials at the time that the US Navy was having all these problems clearing mines. And I remember that this led to a lot of incredulity across the world at that time. Well, I would have thought that after that experience, the United States would take dealing with mines, the question of dealing with mines, seriously, and would build up its capabilities in that regard. But on the contrary, the opposite appears to have happened. And it seems, from what Tom Sharp, and by the way, a number of others also say, that US capability dealing with sea mines has actually reduced. And Tom Sharp makes the point that sea mines are devastating, that if they are sown in the sea, they carry huge amounts of explosives, that the hulls of ships, including Navy ships, can actually sometimes be quite thin, and that's especially true of tankers. Tankers can absorb a lot of damage from drones, but they cannot absorb damage from mines. If mines are sown across the Persian Gulf, it's almost inconceivable that tankers would want to operate. And of course, if they did, and one of them was destroyed, and the hull was pierced, well, if large amounts of crude oil was released, we would have an ecological and environmental disaster over and above and on top all of the other disasters that we have seen. So anyway, nothing that I have seen about these military deployments seems to me to resolve the underlying question of the Strait of Hormuz. The forces being discussed at the present time are insufficient to force open the Strait of Hormuz. And if the Iranians finally do that which they have threatened to do, but have not yet done, at least not in any huge degree, which is to start to plant mines in the Persian Gulf around the Strait of Hormuz, something they have not done because that would interfere with their own shipping. But if the Iranians do that, and they have consistently shown that rather than make concessions, they would prefer to absorb economic damage, even to themselves, than make those concessions. Anyway, if the Iranians do that, well, the United States Navy apparently has no immediate or serious answer to the problem. And of course, it could take months to clear the mines, even in peaceful conditions, and until the mines are cleared, it's difficult to imagine that the ships, the tankers would move, that the ship owners would move the tankers, or that the insurers would allow the tankers to move. Now, Senator Lindsey Graham, who cannot ever even dream of retreating from a difficult situation, who always looks to take the most aggressive, confrontational approach that he can. Anyway, he has now joined advocates for an operation against Kharg Island. And there are reports all over the media today, including the British media, that this is the idea that is now increasingly attractive to Donald Trump himself. An operation to capture Kharg Island. I understand that the originator of this idea is Michael Rubin, a neocon with an extraordinary pedigree going all the way back to the 90s. I can remember him, one of the most vociferous advocates of military action by the United States in the early 2000s. Anyway, he's still around. He's still arguing in exactly the same way that he always has. And he says that the capture of Kharg Island is the way to force Iran into compliance. Loss of Kharg Island will lead finally either to the collapse of the government in Iran or to a situation where that government, because it's lost its major source of export revenue, is brought to that point of crisis where it is forced to capitulate and to negotiate on American terms. Well, Michael Rubin, in my experience, despite the vehement way in which he expresses himself, has proved consistently wrong about pretty much everything I've ever read him to say. And of course, in terms of military operations, I would argue that the same is also basically true of Senator Graham. Now, I've discussed Kharg Island at length in previous programs. People like Jim Webb and others have talked about how trying to capture Kharg Island would be to lead the US into a trap, that there is little cover, that it is small, that the Iranians could continue to bombard and shell any US troops stationed on Kharg Island, potentially inflicting heavy casualties, that the helicopter carriers would have to cross the Strait of Hormuz, which is dangerous and problematic in itself, probably can't be done. And that anyway, that this isn't a good plan. Very provocatively, an article in Responsible Statecraft, the journal published by the Quincy Institute, has put it most vividly. They suggested that sending American troops to Kharg Island is a case of the United States itself arranging, putting potential hostages in Iran's way. Well, I am not going to go so far, not at all. It just, again, that this looks to me like an incredibly high-risk venture, one which has all the potential to go catastrophically wrong. And if it is ever attempted and it does go wrong, well, saying that there would be no political way back for Donald Trump after a disaster of that kind would be a gross understatement. I cannot imagine, I don't have the ability to imagine what the political effect of such a military disaster might be in the United States. Certainly, there would be a terrible reckoning. And I would not advise any political leader to want to be a party to it. The fact that these ideas, these dangerous ideas, are floating around on blocking the Strait of Hormuz by force, seizing Harg Island, what they all show is how deep, how much of a problem the United States is facing at this time. I saw yet another article in the Financial Times talking about how Donald Trump has now positioned himself in a vice of his own making. I've discussed in previous programs, Zugzwang, that the United States, that rather Donald Trump himself, is in Zugzwang, where any move you make is going to get you into very, very serious problems. It's going to make your situation worse. I don't think that the United States, that the president, has any good options in this situation. But here is what I think he should do. He should contact the one man who perhaps does have some leverage. If this Russian aid is flowing to Iran in the way that I said, which I believe it is, then that is providing this man, who is obviously Vladimir Putin, with leverage. And what I think Trump should do is not make proposals to the Iranians through Putin, or even ask Putin for ideas and proposals. I think what he should do is something far less ambitious, which is to ask Putin to persuade the Iranians to get to agree finally to talks with the Americans. Talks which perhaps the Russians might mediate. And who knows, it might be that these talks would have to take place in Russia or someplace friendly to Russia. But at least it would get a process of dialogue and contact between the United States and the Iranians underway. And obviously, Witkoff and Kushner are not the right people to conduct it. Serious people, I mean, actually, really serious people. There are some from the US State Department and the Department of Defense, as I will still call it. They should be asked to become involved. Perhaps some of the people who have been retired, who are retired, former service officers who used to do this sort of thing for the United States before, the kind of people who understand how to negotiate with someone like Araghchi. And perhaps, just possibly, through this process, a way out might be found. Well, I doubt that Donald Trump or Netanyahu are even thinking about these possibilities. But in the meantime, the longer they take, the worse things become. On the Duran, we were privileged to have a discussion about the global economic situation with Ray Tsukano. You can see the program, it'll come out shortly on the Duran. He was discussing the situation in global energy markets, in the global economy altogether. There's been an article by Ambrose Evans-Pritchard in the Daily Telegraph, which is eerily I was going to say suspiciously similar to some of the analysis that Ray Sukarno has been providing. Anyway, Ray's view, which I have no doubt is correct, is that the full shock, the economic shock, has not yet hit home in the West, so that the closure of the Strait of Hormuz for the moment is affecting the poorer Asian customers, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Indonesia. Indonesia used to be an oil producer, but they're now desperately turning up in Moscow. Indonesia, of course, is a BRICS country, and they're asking the Russians to supply them with oil and naphtha and all of these products, which they used to source from the Persian Gulf, but which they cannot receive in any other way. Anyway, they're now asking the Russians for that kind of assistance. These are the countries that are affected at the moment. So far, the big rich industrial societies of Northeast Asia, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, they still have some inventories they can draw on. They still are able to spend large amounts of money buying whatever oil there is still there on the and LNG there is still there on the markets. But eventually, they too will start to run short. Ray Sukarno made the point that a lot of Taiwan has mostly sourced its helium from the Persian Gulf. Helium gas is no longer being supplied to Taiwan from the Persian Gulf area. Without helium gas, Taiwan can't produce its advanced chips because they are an indispensable part of the production process. Eventually, this will start to have its effect. Probably, and in time, all of these East Asian producers, the industrial producers, Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, will be obliged to turn to the Russians, who do produce helium gas and naphtha and oil and all of these things. Already there are reports that South Korea is starting to do so. It's outside the scope of this program, but regardless of what Kaya Kallas and Friedrich Merz and Ursula von der Leyen are saying, in the face of this crisis, the entire sanctions regime on Russia, painstakingly constructed since February 2022, and never fully effective or even remotely effective, but that sanctions regime is now rapidly breaking down. And in East Asia, we can see that process moving forward by leaps and bounds. In fact, before long, with Russia being the big swing producer, able to produce oil and LNG and naphtha and fertilizer products and aluminium and all of these other things that came from the Persian Gulf, we're going to start to see a scramble for all of these resources. Countries are going to line up and they're going to send delegations to Moscow begging the Russians to provide them, to supply them with these items. Remember, fertilizer is essential for agricultural production. If there are shortages, global shortages of fertilizer, then food prices are going to rise with catastrophic effects in the global south across many, many countries. Anyway, before long, we're going to see a whole cavalcade of people heading to Moscow, begging the Russians for help with all of these things. The Russians produce all of these things. The Russians will start driving not just hard bargains, but insisting on long-term bargains. They will tell the Japanese and the South Koreans and the Taiwanese and the Indonesians and the Malaysians and all of the others. They will say, yes, look, we are prepared to provide you with whatever of the items we could spare for you, given all of these competing demands. But in return, we want to be absolutely guaranteed that if the Americans and the Europeans come round in a few months, start threatening you with secondary sanctions because you are buying these things from us, this time you will say publicly, categorically no. There should be no more of this game that the Indian government played of buying oil from Russia, pretending that they weren't buying oil from Russia, reducing some quantities so as to keep the Americans happy. There must be no more of this sort of thing. You see how dependent on us you are. You see how dependent you are on our supplies. If you want those supplies to continue to flow towards you, then you must guarantee that this time it is forever. It cannot happen any other way. That is the way long-term contracts work. That is the way the trust is built up. So one way or the other, we're going to see, the longer this goes on for, the collapse of the Western sanctions regime. Donald Trump may say it's for 30 days, but beyond those 30 days, if we're going to see this continued crisis in global markets, not just for energy, but for all of these other goods, then inevitably the sanctions regime on Russia is going to completely break down. And not just on Russia, because Ray Zagano and others, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, have pointed out that there is a delay effect on the full effects reaching Europe and the United States as well. Persian Gulf oil and all of these products goes first to Asia because these are the places in closest proximity to the Persian Gulf producers. It takes 15 to 20 days for cargoes of oil and other goods from the Persian Gulf to reach Europe. That means that the Europeans are still receiving oil and natural gas and other things from the Persian Gulf producers that departed through the Strait of Hormuz before the attack, the American-Israeli attack on the 28th of February. But eventually, that will start to run down, and then at that point, in a week, 2 weeks, a month's time, we are going to see the Europeans themselves start to face the accumulated short problem of shortages of petrol, of LNG, of diesel oil, of naphtha, of fertilizer, of all of these products that they cannot source from the Persian Gulf and which they are refusing, incredibly, still to buy from the Russians. And at that point, we're going to see prices surge in Europe. That's going to put upward pressure on interest rates. That could lead to a recession. And of course, eventually, despite the fact that the United States is itself self-sufficient in energy, all of this is going to start to affect the United States too. Now, I have been saying, ever since the Germans in particular, back in February, March 2022, gambled the entire energy future of Germany and Europe on American LNG. And Germany, it should be said, imports more than 90% of its LNG from the United States. That puts Germany and Europe in a catastrophically vulnerable, exposed position, that the United States has a previous history of placing restrictions on its energy exports in order to contain price growth within the US domestic market. The political imperative to do that in the United States now, with the midterms approaching, is enormous. I saw yesterday reports, again in the Financial Times, but you can find them all across the media in the United States too, that there are already assurances being given both by the industry and by the administration that the United States at the moment is not looking to prohibit exports of energy products. Now, when I read articles like that, when I read that for the moment, the idea of restricting energy exports is not being discussed in the United States, I take that as an infallible sign that it is being discussed in the United States. Anybody who thinks otherwise is naive for thinking it. And if no way can be found to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, to start to get traffic in goods moving through the Strait of Hormuz within an approximate period of time, if this conflict drags on to September, as some are saying, well, I personally believe that the United States stopping supplies of energy products to Europe, exports of energy products altogether, given the political imperatives, that is almost a done thing. It will happen. The only question is whether the restrictions on energy export will be total or only partial. If they're partial, that will still cause unbearable stresses in Europe itself. So one would assume that the president and his officials were looking at all of this. They were making calculations about the risks of military operations in the Straits of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf and in Harg Island. They were aware of the movement of supplies from probably ultimately Russia into Iran through Iran's Caspian Sea ports and via Central Asia. And they would do what I said they should do. Pick up the telephone, talk to Vladimir Putin, see whether some kind of formal negotiating process with the Iranians can finally be set up. And I would suggest also that if the United States were to do that, then it should tell its Israeli ally to stop assassinating Iranian leaders, which is something that can only get in the way of negotiations. And for the record, I would also suggest that in order at least to de-escalate the crisis, the United States and Israel should also stop launching missile attacks and bombing strikes on Iran itself. The Iranians might be prepared to reciprocate. In that, they would probably, however, still insist on keeping the Strait of Hormuz closed, but then the whole negotiation would be about getting the Strait of Hormuz reopened, and it would be, the issue would then be, what price would the Iranians demand for that, we would not have this production destruction take place, the missile strike on the gas plants in Qatar, which have destroyed 17% of the production capacity. The Qataris are saying that it could take months, if not years, to get that back into operation. We would hopefully see an end to all of that, which hopefully would also mean that once the Strait of Hormuz were reopened, then with repairs being done to the production facilities, products could start to exit the Strait of Hormuz again, improving the conditions for the supply conditions across the world economy. Will President Trump and his officials do anything of that kind? Well, we saw from his comments today from Prime Minister Netanyahu that if Trump really gets heavy on him, he does talk Trump's tune. I've always felt myself that the ultimate problem in Washington are the hardliners in Washington itself. People like Senator Graham and Michael Rubin and people of that kind. But the president needs to make some very hard decisions. To my mind, the midterms are already lost. But if this thing is ended now in this messy way that I've said, but at least we start to move towards some way to end it, well, something might still be retrieved from the wreckage of his presidency. I don't think the president will follow this advice. Obviously, he's not going to hear this advice from me, because I doubt that he listens to me. But perhaps he will listen to other people in his administration who are giving him advice similar to mine. Well, we shall see. As for the Russians, they will, of course, exact a price. And the price will surely be an end of further supplies to Ukraine, including perhaps intelligence assistance. The president should have little trouble agreeing to this. The Russians, by the way, yesterday confirmed that the trilateral negotiations between themselves, the Americans and the Ukrainians are now indefinitely suspended. I doubt that the Russians were ever very interested in them, to say the truth. And this morning, the vice chairman of Russia's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, one of the most powerful people in Russia, perhaps the second most powerful person in Russia, has published one of his famously vivid comments, in which he says that nobody in Russia would ever negotiate with Zelensky. It would be utter shame to do so. Zelensky, in other words, must go, and go completely, in order for there to be a deal. And Medvedev made parallels with the Second World War, and he used the words unconditional surrender. Again, I have to say that I read this post of Medvedev's as both offering advice and acting as a sort of warning to Vladimir Putin himself, just saying, no more negotiations. Let's focus on the war. Now, I am not going to discuss the situation in the war today. I've spoken at great length about other things. I will return to that soon. But suffice to say that, as everybody can see, as Bart De Wever in Belgium is admitting. The war in Ukraine is lost. Realistically, it's been lost from the moment it really started. Sooner or later, in one form or another, the Russians, unless there was a political crisis or collapse in Moscow, were going to win. The events that have played out over the last few weeks have brought forward that moment. Pete Hegseth is again complaining about the depletion in the American arsenals from the shipping of weapons by the Biden administration to Ukraine. The president himself is known to share that opinion. If the price of pulling the rug, if the price of getting out of this mess in the Middle East is pulling the rug from under Zelensky and the various people in Europe who support Zelensky, Starmer, Macron, Merz, Ursula, Callas, all of those people. Well, surely that is a price Donald Trump ought to be prepared to pay. Well, I say all of this. I don't expect him to do any of the things that I've discussed in this programme. It's just that I always say that when people say that there is no alternative, actually, there always is. I set it out as I see it in this programme. We'll see whether sense, reason prevails. It rarely does. Almost certainly it won't. But what is the point of these programmes if I don't point it out, at least from time to time? Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, as well as Substack. You can also support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Thank you. Have a very good day. More from me soon.